The title of the sermon is The Price of Discipleship. Matthew laid out his account of the gospel thematically, as we've already discussed, and Jesus' preaching was received, as we've seen, as being different from the scribes. And the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority. When Jesus confronts the world, many of the world's expectations are simply destroyed. It is clear from the Gospels that Jesus did not fit in the model of Jewish culture that they had made for him. He would not do the things they would expect, say the things expected, or be the man they expected. One might say that in every way, Jesus was a surprise. Jesus' disciples, even convinced that Jesus was worthy of their full devotion through his ministry, were constantly puzzled by Jesus. They too were even expecting something different from the Lord than what they got. When Jesus confronts the world today, similar misconceptions must often be cleared away. Oftentimes I see in ministry, and we're all guilty of it, we've been guilty of it at times, where we form God into our own image. The way I think about the world is the way God thinks about the world. The way I think about people is the way God thinks about people. And we need to get rid of our misconceptions as we re-encounter Jesus in this account of the gospel. When reading the comments of others regarding the Son of Man, one will realize quickly that the comments on Jesus as presented in the books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John provide for the most varied and contradictory opinions in all the commentaries that you can read, maybe save Revelation. There's not mass consensus about what Jesus actually meant. Even among conservative scholars, you read them, one believes this, one believes that. Why? Because we still find Jesus puzzling. We have to study him carefully. And I don't believe anybody's got everything right about Jesus. And I think when we get there, we're going to have a lot of things straightened out. But the collective church cannot come to hard conclusions when interpreting Jesus and what he taught to this day. But we need to remember that God's ways are not our ways. So we gladly continue on our journey this morning, trying to understand the Lord better this morning, trying to reinforce what we already know clearly, and get rid of our misconceptions and our bad theology as we move along. The outline is thus: the price of discipleship and the response of the disciples, a two-point outline this morning. And here we see, now when Jesus saw a crowd, he gave orders to go to the other side. So he's off the heels of the Sermon on the Mount. There's a great crowd around him, and he says, we're going to the other side. That meant either 7 or 13 miles, depending on where he exactly was talking about. But a little bit of a boat ride. When you look at the Sea of Galilee, we would call it a Lake Galilee. You know, it doesn't look that impressive from up high, but you get out on the open water, and 13 miles is actually quite a long ways by water. So we often see, too, in the Scriptures, Jesus withdrawing from crowds. He needs to recharge. He's fully man. He gets tired. There are times where he's pulling away from the crowd. They have expectations on him that he's not interested in. We also find him that he invested most of his work in smaller groups. One-on-one, one-on-three, one-on-12, one-on-70. Most of his ministry was not catering to crowds. It was teaching disciples how to be more like him, so that when they received their commission, that they would be ready for it. So as they were leaving, two others wanted to join their cohort. Two guys said, hey, let's get in this boat with Jesus. Perhaps they heard the sermon. I think most likely they did. They wanted to take off with Jesus. Let us come with you. And the first guy we see is a scribe. Now the scribes were not just copy machines of the day. They knew the Bible well. Can you imagine your only job, or one of your main jobs, is to copy the Word of God again and again and again? You'd know it pretty well. You know, they say writing something is like saying it 11 times. They were underneath the rabbis, or just below teachers. So as far as their level of political influence, if I could say that. We see the scribe of the text calling Jesus teacher as he wanted to join his ministry. The title of teacher for Jesus was used elsewhere in Matthew by Jesus' rivals and naysayers. This has led many to conclude that Matthew starts to present Jesus' rivals right here now. These are the guys that are going to be opposed to him, the guys that call him teacher, these leaders in Israel called the scribes. The title of teacher was accurate, but not adequate. In our culture, we still have people like this. You know, have you ever heard people say, well, I don't believe Jesus was the Son of God, but I believe he was a good teacher. Well, that's real quagmire that people work themselves into when that's the case. Because Jesus was either God, is God, Jesus was the Son of God, Jesus' death was necessary and required for the sin of human beings to be atoned for, or he was crazy. You can't be a good teacher and call yourself God if you're not. We call those people crazy people. They're mentally ill. But yet, the scribes, oftentimes they'd call him teacher, but it was tongue-in-cheek. So this has led some commentaries and commentators to say that, hey, this guy was disingenuous. Now, I don't see that from the text, but I'm a soft yes on that. It could be where Matthew is introducing his arch-enemies at this time. But we don't know that for sure. What we do see is Jesus, he did not encourage or discourage the man. He just simply told him, this is what you got to give up. If you get in this boat, this is what you've got to give up. And for him, it was, hey, you're not going to be able to go home tonight. You get in this boat. That's what's going on right here at this decision right here, right now. You're not going home. Now imagine you're a lawyer. And you got a lot of peers, and people are coming to hear this Jesus, and this is a wonderful sermon. And now all of a sudden you got to walk around with a homeless guy. And what are your peers going to think about you when you're doing that? When you're this highfalutin lawyer, when you're this up-and-coming leader in the nation of Israel, what are they going to say about you? That's what this man was confronted with, nothing less. Jesus was very busy traveling from one place to another, as we know, and he had a more austere life than the lives of birds and foxes. He's like, those animals, they have places to live, but I don't. Nor will you if you're going to be my disciple. On a spiritual level, we were reminded too that we are sojourners in this place. This is not our home. We are not to grow attached to this place. And the more we live in this place today, I think the easier it is to detach from it, right? We look around and say, this is not what I used to know. This is not familiar. But it should have always been that way. It should have never been a place where we were, quote unquote, comfortable. Who's comfortable in a foreign land when they're living there amongst people that aren't like them, that don't think like them, that don't act like them? And when we get comfortable with the world, we don't have the right outlook. We're passing through this place. We need to remember that on a spiritual level. Then you have the grieving son. We see an improvement in his title. Look at what he said. He called Jesus Lord. This man had to give something up too. Here, it was social norms. Jesus used what France called shock tactics to present his radical demands. An eldest son would have had the responsibility of bearing his father. But Jesus seems indifferent to this when he, in essence, said, let the spiritually dead bury the physically dead, including your father. Many Christians want to sand the edges off of Jesus' teaching by explaining away his sharp demands. And here, Carson did that. He got out his sandpaper and he thought it was necessary to, quote, question whether Jesus was really forbidding attendance at the father's funeral. He said, that's an honest question. We need to ask that question. But France made a good point here. If the consecration of a Nazirite or of a high priest did not allow him to even attend his own father's funeral, Jesus' demand is no less absolute. France says, listen, this was a Nazirite vow. A Nazirite couldn't attend his own father's funeral, and you're saying Jesus didn't really mean that he couldn't attend his father's funeral? Jesus was saying, look, we're going to the other side of the lake, and if you get in this boat, you're not going back. It's a decision right then and there. And oftentimes that's what happens in discipleship. Oftentimes you and I are just going through life. You know, Abraham, he's just going through life. Go to a land I'll show you. That's it. He's just out doing his thing. And then, boom, here's God knocking on his door, knocking on his mind, heart. He knew exactly what he was supposed to do. Leave. And you just start walking. Is this unfamiliar? Does this kind of sound familiar? Follow me. I don't think we need sandpaper on these things. We see them. Moses is just guarding some sheep. I am shows up in the burning bush, says, go back to Egypt where they wanted to kill you. Take my people out of there. Well, I stutter. God find somebody else to do it. No. When God comes knocking, oftentimes he puts us on the spot. And we need to remember that. It's one thing you see at the boat that's easily overlooked is he put those men in a place they weren't ready for. And he says, what's it going to be? Are you getting in this boat? Or are you going to stay here? The theological truth of that we can take away from this man here and his father's funeral is cultural responsibilities were diminished at this point. Jesus is saying, we don't have time for the cultural stuff. We're on a mission of the kingdom here. And it trumps your responsibility as an eldest son to go bury your father. Sounds harsh, but isn't that true? I mean, how much more important is people's salvation, just like we prayed for this morning, instead of a funeral? And Jesus is like, there's nothing you can do with the man in the coffin, so to speak. There's people dying and going to hell right in front of us, everywhere around us, all the time. And oftentimes we're distracted, as we've already talked about, by the things of society and the social normativeness of our lives. Jesus used the Son of Man as a title for himself when we read that beautiful passage out of Daniel. This phrase is so used in the New Testament, 82 times. 69 times in the Synoptics and 29 times in Matthew alone. In every instance, except for two, it is a term that Jesus used of himself. It's his favorite one. This is his favorite title. To us now, when we look back, we see what Son of Man really means. It's unclear if the audience would have gravitated to the passage in Daniel when Jesus was titling himself Son of Man. But we now have the benefit of looking back. And it's not just a Christological title with its only purpose to inform the reader of who Jesus is. The title is a self-designation describing Jesus the man, the human being, and as Kingsbury wrote, earthly, suffering, vindicated, and I would add glorified. The Son of Man's coming back again, and through all of his ministry explains that he was and is a human just like us. Just like us. And we forget that. And he overcame. The last Adam overcame where the first Adam failed. And he's coming back. And the Son of Man encompasses his whole ministry. Him being the unique one, the only begotten Son of God. But I want you to note here, after this conversation that we read just now, discipleship started on the other side. We see Matthew kicking off his ministry with the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' ministry. And then they go out to the boat, and he says, this is where discipleship starts, right here, right now. The people getting in this boat, they are disciples. And the people that aren't, are not disciples. One of the themes of the account of the gospel is to focus on Jesus investing in small groups of the people. As I said, he's just constantly sowing into the lives of, he's hanging out with three disciples. You know, if the mega synagogue would have been a thing back then, and that would have been a way to reach people, Jesus would have been doing that. Jesus is like, let's put a few people on the boat. And that's what we're going to change the world in. That boat is going to start everything. The term disciple is used in the New Testament often, obviously. And there are many wordsmiths who articulate what their particular view is on what did Jesus mean when he used the word disciple. And I would remind us here that many words have zero meaning outside of their context. That's Bible study 101. Disciple is no different. The word was used for 12 men who walked with Jesus 3+ years or plus or minus 3 years. It was used to describe students of other teachers as well, like John the Baptist. It was used to describe larger groups of people and as a synonym in Acts for Christians. But I take issue with Carson again this morning, and I bring him up by name, not dogging him out. he would disagree with me, and he's a very sharp man. He's a lot smarter than I am. But I bring people up not to say that I know better than these guys, but to tell you, when you're reading things on the internet, when you are reading comments from people, you and I need to know the Word very well, because we can be led astray by even the best. I don't care if you're Alistair Begg, Chuck Swindoll, I don't care who you are. Every man is going to teach something that's not true. Now, we don't know what those things are, but all of our words have to line up with the Bible. I take issue with Carson. He put the term disciple. He put forth the idea that it means a broad spectrum of people who are at that point following Jesus. Instead, I say, hey, no, France, Blomberg, and Constable got it right. They saw the term needing to be defined in the context in which it appears. Here, it means more of a committed follower of Christ. The people that wanted to follow Jesus, I mean, more than likely, these people were people of faith. They're going to be in heaven, if you want my take. Now, maybe the scribe, maybe not. I don't know. But the man that wanted to go to a funeral, Jesus is not talking to them about how to come to God. He's saying, look, if you want to be my disciple, you're going to have to give up something right here, right now. It doesn't mean that they didn't know God. They're not in heaven. They're not going to heaven. It didn't mean that they didn't have a life of faith to live outside of being in that boat that day. But disciple, when Jesus uses it, your radar needs to go up and say, what is he saying here about disciple? And oftentimes we think one word, well, see in Acts, it's a synonym for Christian. That's what Jesus meant. Well, no. And my famous one that I use is from Trina, trunk. Tell me what I'm meaning. You have no idea what I mean by trunk. You might be thinking car trunk, tree trunk, elephant trunk, moving trunk. It needs words around it. Disciple is no different. And our radar needs to go up. And when Jesus says, you can't be my disciple if dot, 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 he means you can't be my disciple. If you don't hate your father, mother, brother, sister, if you don't hate your family, you can't be my disciple. Is Jesus using hyperbole? Of course. But hyperbole for a reason, to drive home a truth. So what's the application? This still remains a prerequisite today. Anyone who wants to follow Jesus closely as a disciple must be willing to give up many of the normal comforts of life. Following Him involves going where He directs, doing what He commands. And as a disciple, Jesus takes precedent over enjoying the normal comforts of life whenever these conflict. Jesus is not saying you can't go to a birthday party, but there may be times where He says you got other things to do. Discipleship will cost every devotee something, though. I'll tell you what, find me the example where being a disciple of Christ didn't cost somebody something. In the Gospels, find it. It doesn't exist. There's always a price tag associated with it. And oftentimes we want to tip our hat to it and think that, hey, I'm a disciple of Christ. Well, read the resume for it. It's pretty stark. It's striking. Discipleship in its essence is a call to die. If you want a simple definition, discipleship is a chance to die, to say no to your own life in significant ways oftentimes. And what does that mean? Well, following Christ, you never know what He may ask you. But the question is, are you ready to hear if He did call your number? You ask people that have been faced with decisions like that where God came knocking and said, what's it going to be? And some of them will tell you their life flashed right before their eyes because they saw the death that was going to happen to their own life and how it was going to change and how things would never be the same. Follow their stories. So now that we've looked at the price of following Jesus, let's look at the response of the disciples. Somebody read verses 23 through 27. 23 through 27. This boat ride was one they would never forget. You know, very frequently our experience of something is different than our expectation. You know, to them, they thought, You know, we're just going across the lake. Not a big deal. These are fishermen, a lot of them. They're used to being in boats, hanging around the lake. This is the area a lot of them are from. And they're just going across the lake. Everything's grand. Can you picture it? I see the disciples, they were feeling warm and fuzzy. They had heard Jesus say, look, if you get in this boat, you're going to have to give up something. And they're like, we're ready to give up something. I could see them almost whispering to each other, I'm a disciple. I'm a disciple. We're disciples. And then this storm comes, this mega storm. Bam! The storm of their life. They think, we're going to die right here, right now. I don't know what kind of storm this was, if this was the most violent storm on the Sea of Galilee, but when fishermen think they're going to die, it was a bad storm. And the Sea of Galilee is very deep, by the way. Very deep lake. It's not like you're going to bob out there, jump up and down. These guys thought, we're doomed. We better wake Jesus up. And here's the kicker. They thought he could do something. But then when he did it, they were surprised. Jesus, you need to wake up and do something. And then he did. They're like, wow. Isn't that how we oftentimes deal with Jesus? Jesus, do something. And then he does it. And we're like, wow, that was amazing, Jesus. Almost like they didn't expect him to do anything. There was a man named Borncombe. He saw a paradigm or a pattern, if you will, of the danger and glory of discipleship. He sees it clearly. These disciples that are being talked about in Matthew, they signed up for a dangerous life. Not only from a storm, that was just the beginning. That's how things got kicked off. Let's kick it off with a storm you've never seen. But think about these men. Man, these men were tested with money. They had their egos stepped on. They faced challenges in their families. They wandered around homeless. They came face to face with their individual hang-ups, and they had a target on their back just like their teacher from day one. They had all of that. They lived a dangerous life, and they embraced it. And we as men in our society, we've lost a little bit of that. It's all about staying safe. Oh, love to hear that quote on the radio. I love that. Stay safe out there. Jesus says, come and die. Come and risk. Risk it all on me. And these men said, I'm ready. But then they were shocked when the sea was calmed. These men were people just like us. They chose discipleship, but growth took time. They had to learn much about themselves. They were starting their journey, but they responded with fear right here, and it wouldn't be the last time. When you and I come into contact with God's will in our life, it can be a scary thing. How about Abraham? Go sacrifice your son. I wonder what thoughts went through Abraham's mind when he was commanded to do that. Jesus rebuked them constantly at their lack of faith. And Jesus was teaching what has been said before. Faith chases out fear, or fear chases out faith. Faith chases out fear, or fear chases out faith. They can't survive together. Why did Matthew give this account here? Well, one of Matthew's points surely was to teach us that Jesus has power over all creation. But I don't believe it's the main point at all. In verse 23, we see the repetition of key words, disciples and followed. This strongly suggests what he's getting at. Disciples followed Christ, even though they risked it all. Plainly stated, they got in the boat. So what's the application? I believe the Bible is clear as anything else it could state. It talks about what discipleship is and what it's not in the clearest terms I can read. It's not some mysterious thing. The unfortunate thing is we want to automatically place ourselves as a disciple when we're talking about our own lives oftentimes. But it must be chosen. Discipleship is a real opportunity for each one of us to say to ourselves, am I ready to give up everything that makes me comfortable for the kingdom of God? Am I ready right here, right now, to get in a boat and leave everything comfortable behind for Christ if He calls my number? That's the discipleship question. It's nothing less than that. Am I ready to give up all I own if I knew and heard the clarion call of God to do something for the kingdom that required everything I own? Am I ready for that? And if the answer is no, it's just that you and I haven't accepted discipleship. It's not sinful. The baseline is love your neighbor as yourself. Discipleship on its highest level is dying for the sins of the world. That's what Jesus did. And on our level, discipleship is being the slave of all humanity. You and I, as long as we're loving our neighbor as ourselves, we're not in sin. When we're treating people the way we want to be treated, we are not in sin. But Jesus said, if you want more than that, here's how you get it. That's where discipleship is found. In the servanthood of all human beings, in the slavery of all human beings. It's found in those areas of life, which are different than the floor of love your neighbor as yourself. And until we understand that, we will continue to confuse discipleship with something that it isn't, with something that it actually is. When you and I choose discipleship, you better know that the storm is coming. There's going to be problems in your life. There's going to be times where you don't understand what the Lord is doing. It all seemed romantic on the front end, but then the trials came. The fear set in. And the longevity of it all wore us out. That's what we choose when we sign up for it. Oftentimes, it's more than what we bargained for. It surprises us, not only out of the gate, but long term. So what can help us? What can help us to maybe evaluate where we are with how do we get, am I ready to be a disciple? I don't even know if that's true of me today, right now. There have been times where I think I've gotten it right, and times where I've known I've blown it. And then you could probably say the same thing. But these are important questions. Am I ready to walk away from everything that I know if God were to call me clearly to do such a thing? So how do we do that? Well, we got to know that, look, God is sovereign. It was impossible for Jesus to drown, for He came to die for the sins of the world. And if the disciples had understood that, they could have rode that storm out and go, wow, what a storm, and Jesus waking up on the other side. But that's not what happened. And we got to cut them some slack. I'm not saying that it would have been different if I'd have been there. I don't think it would have. I'd have been waking him up sooner. But if we remember that God is sovereign, that goes a long way with helping us to remember that, look, it might not be pleasant what He's calling us to, and oftentimes it's not. Talk to the missionaries that knew they were supposed to go to India in the 1800s, and most of them died there. Talk to their families saying, don't go to India. We hear that they all get this strange fever and constantly die. Don't go. We love you. And they're like, I cannot not go. I must go. I must answer the call to carry the gospel into a foreign, strange land because I know without a doubt that God has called me to do it. And they faced their death, and they did die there. That's discipleship. But that's when you put your hands in the life of God and say, if I die on a foreign mission field, so be it. If my family dies on a foreign mission field, if my kids die on a foreign mission field, so be it. That's what it looks like. Despite the storms of our current world, the world is on God's timetable, and He's going to wrap this place up when He wants to. And you and I can walk in confidence no matter what happens. Doesn't matter what the storm looks like out there. And there's a storm going on. People dying, people acting crazy. Listen, that's always been the case. You and I can stand confidently here and knowing that God has this place under control, that He puts on the thrones anyone He chooses. He chose every leader on the throne today. That He causes calamity, or He allows it calamity, and we ought to be okay with that. And when you and I take that kind of perspective with God, if we drown in the Sea of Galilee, so be it. This life is a vapor. What matters is I answered the call of Christ on my life. It was a voluntary ask. I could have said no and still gone to heaven. Don't confuse those two points. But I'm convinced that almost everyone will get a call from God sometime in their life. I'm almost convinced of it. If you really and I are walking with God, we really want to seek God's face, I believe there's always a time where God will say, how much do you want? How much do you want? Because there's more than most people are saying, well, not that, God. Most people in there. I'll do everything, but not that, God. I won't walk around homeless because I'm a lawyer, God. You know, God, it's my responsibility to go bury my father. I can't not go to his funeral. One day that call's coming if you and I love the Lord. We have an opportunity to do something truly amazing, to risk it all. To risk it all. And I guarantee you, you go interview those disciples up in heaven and say, was it worth it? You have any doubt that they would say it wasn't worth it? Is there any doubt in our minds that Matthew would say, man, no, I wish I'd have not gotten in that boat? Really? We know it's true instinctively, spiritually. We know these things are true. We just have to embrace them. It's true. If I hear from God, I can say yes, because there will be no regret ultimately.